Turning your Bible to Daniel chapter 6, we're picking up this theme of Sunday school stories, and I'm not quite sure what to say about tonight, but Pastor Ian will. We began a couple of weeks ago with Noah, and I wasn't here, so I listened to that as a podcast in the car, and I kind of, you know, Nick's description of people bashing on the doors of the ark as they drowned was like, oh, you know, this is a story we tell our children in Sunday school, you know, and sing those songs. I was so glad that Nick got it right when, because we sang that, you know, the animals went in two by two, hurrah, hurrah. And Nick actually got it right, because they didn't. Did they? No, they didn't. The wild animals went in two by two, and the domestic animals, I'm not talking about cats and dogs, I'm talking about cows and sheep. They went in seven by seven, just so there was a lot more of those for breeding afterwards. But anyway, that was great. And last week we had David walking around with Goliath's head in his hand. And we just thought we'd teach our kids that. Well, actually, we kind of cut that bit off. I mean, well, David cut that bit off, but we kind of, you know, David slew Goliath, and we never tell them what he did afterwards. But anyway, I don't know what's going to happen with Daniel tonight, so let's read it and see. Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him, because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, we'll never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of God. So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors and governors have all agreed that the king should issue a verdict, an edict, and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he'd done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying, asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about the royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except you, O king, will be thrown to the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to the king and said to him, remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. So the king gave the order, And they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done anything wrong before you, O king." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. When Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So reads the word of God. Thanks, Ian.
Thanks, Andrew. Good evening, everybody. Have you had a good day? With it being Father's Day today, I actually wasn't, for once, woken up, because I was actually up and around at about 6 a.m. this morning. So when my kids got up, they panicked because they couldn't find me, and I was already downstairs. But I wonder for you, because obviously, you know, being a father, and there was like a stereotype of, it's my day, I need, you know, to do certain things, i.e. nothing today, because it's my day. That didn't happen in any shape or form. I wonder what sort of priorities you have, what habits you might have, good or bad. Because in some way, we all have different sorts of habits, things that actually shape who we are and what we actually do. Or maybe who or what has the greatest influence over you. I know for me, probably one of my greatest influences is family. And as many of you will know, my father passed away recently. So when I heard that song before, I was kind of like, I'm not going to cry. And actually, this afternoon, we had the privilege of actually committing his ashes into the family grave, where my mother's ashes lay and where his mum and dad are as well. And as I was stood at the graveside, I was thinking of so many things I could and should have said. So when I heard that song as well, I'm thinking, thanks for reminding me. But sometimes, you know, I realize how much of a significant and a massive influence my dad has actually had on me. And that actually, in many ways, I'm turning into him. I don't know if, you know, you find yourself, you say something to your kids or to somebody, and you suddenly think, oh, that's just what mum or dad or whoever else used to say. And so we're now looking at the story of Daniel. And there's a massive influence, or there's a massive potential influence on his life. And it's one of the biggest empires the world had seen, if not the biggest empire the world had ever seen at that point. And this empire needs to be organized. It needs to be ruled and protected well. And the king needs people to look after his interests. And so we look at a bit of how Daniel ends up in the position that he's in. Is that Daniel, along with a few other young men of the royal court of Judah, they're taken from their homeland as the Babylonians come in and they take siege of Israel and Judah and the Holy Land, and they take siege of Jerusalem. They take away some of these young men, some of the young noblemen. And the superior might of the Babylonians takes over and basically wipes out their whole city and takes them away. And the reason for that was that the Israelites had broken their faith and the covenant with God. And the Babylonians under King Nebuchadnezzar were God's instrument to bring God's punishment for breaking his covenant. So now Daniel and the others find themselves in exile in a foreign land. They're at a low point with the real possibility of being absorbed into this new superpower culture and all of its practices, to the point that all their way of life and everything will disappear into the sands of history. So how could God rescue his people from exile with the city and the nation fallen? What of the promises that Abraham's descendants will be a blessing to the nations? And what of the promises to Isaac, Jacob, and Moses and David? All seems hopeless. All that they knew, all that they had treasured, was now many, many miles away. It was no longer theirs. However, the king selects Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that took some practice, and others as the strong, the healthy, the good-looking young men who are well versed in all learning and all knowledge, so that they could be of use to the king and his court, because they are to serve the kingdom. But there's another influence comes in. They are given Babylonian names. Belteshazzar, I never get that one right, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all which have some sort of link to the Babylonian gods. So from having names that talk about God and his faithfulness, and God and his trustworthiness, and God and his powerfulness, they now start go by the names of these foreign gods. But Daniel and his companions are a great example of faith and integrity in times of oppression, in difficult times. Leading up to the story that we're looking at today, they've already been tested with decrees that the previous kings have given that go against God's law, whether it's eating unclean meat or worshipping idols. They keep their reliance on God, Yahweh, alone. They do not defile themselves in any way. So what we see Daniel going through all these tests and trials and interpreting of the king's dreams and seeing kings come and go in this empire. We see him grow in favor and serving the royal court in total for almost 70 years of his life is spent serving a foreign empire. And it includes the takeover of the Babylonian Empire by the Persians, and thereby creating the largest empire we've ever seen so far. Yet despite all this change in government and in practices and in whatever else, continually you'll see, as you read through the other stories, Daniel continues to grow in favor because he has good character, he has integrity, and he has a good standing, and he shows wisdom. So Daniel, now some 70 years old, is placed in high office along with two others as administrator over the 120 provinces and to protect the king's interests right the way across the empire. And originally, he was coming from exile, and he now stands with just two others overseeing the whole of this massive empire, which spreads from Asia right the way through Babylon, right the way down, and starts touching into Egypt and beyond. A massive empire. And Daniel is standing there governing over and looking over the 120 provinces because he's got integrity and he's got good character. And he proves himself more capable and trustworthy, more exceptional than all his other counterparts. With him, as we read, there is no corruption or seeking his own gain by abusing this power that he has. And so the king starts to plan to set him in charge over the entire kingdom. And this was a young man brought into exile from another nation. And again, we see Daniel prospering because he's faithful to God, he's got good character, and he's got integrity. And now in a pagan land, is at the point of being second only to the king himself. We could stop there. That is just absolutely incredible. However, as with all good stories, there's a bit of a bad side to it as well. And some of his counterparts aren't happy with this. And they want to stop what's happening. And so they try to find some way of bringing Daniel down. There must be something, there must be some chink in his armor, in his integrity, in his character, that we can get at, that we can stop him from getting this power. Because surely we should have this power for ourselves. And so this group meet and they can't find anything. So they start to turn their ways to underhand measures. And they decide they're going to test Daniel's loyalty. Is it really to the king? Or is it to his God? And I'm sure they had no doubt what Daniel's response would be. Because time and again, his loyalty and his faith to God's been tested. And time and again, he stood firm in his faith and said, "My God is faithful. Whatever you throw against me, God is faithful." So they come up with this plan to see whether he would actually put the king above his own God. And so they go to the king and they make this appeal under the guise of truth and justice, and appealing to the king's pride, they butter him up a bit. "Oh, king, may you live forever. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, you probably look lovely today. Oh, yes, those robes are just beautiful. And by the way, isn't it right that you do this?" With the full intent that they want to bring his most loyal subject down. And so they convince the king that a law should be signed which cannot be broken or revoked. Because within the Persian custom in their empire, and a big feature of the dynasty was that once a law had been signed, it was not allowed to be broken. There's an example, as I was looking into this, that within the reign of Darius, see, I want to say, how did you say it, Andrew? I want to say Darius. I thought you cheated. Well, I'm going to say in the reign of Darius III, he as king actually put to death a man that he knew was innocent. He could prove his innocence, but because he passed a law, he had to put the man to death. And in the moments after he put the man to death, He said, I stand here and I repent because I have erred. I have made a mistake. So even the king, once he's passed and signed that law cannot be broken. It has to be fulfilled. And yet what we see is that Daniel has a very high value. It's probably even higher than the value that the Persians had about their written laws. Because he highly values and has a great habit, which is of prayer. 3 times a day, every day, Daniel went to his room, opened his windows, and would pray. And no man-made law would ever change that for Daniel. Because Daniel knows that when he hears about this law that he's being framed. And if the possibility occurred to him to change his routine or to pray without appearing to do so, it was dismissed for Daniel without question. He was not going to change what had been his habit for his life. Because to him, he's going to pray just as he's always done, giving thanks to God. Because it's God that has been there through every single one of these kings that he served in the past. It's God that has been there when his friends were facing the fiery furnace. Why would he now change any of that because somebody's now passed a new law? Because he knows God, the one true God, is faithful. And so he's praying with the windows open toward Jerusalem, as he's always done. And he's praying openly without shame or fear, knowing that this law's been passed, knowing that there's severe consequences. But for him, the thought of not having God in his everyday life was far worse than anything man could do to him. Because he knew to let God down was far greater a sin than to let man down. For him, for Daniel, his hope is in God alone. No matter what is going on around him, God is number one. The holy city and his nation may be in ruins, but God is still using his people in exile to bring about his plans and his purposes. And Daniel knows that he's got a part to play in that. And if it means losing his life, then so be it. So the group of accusers have gone purposely to his house. They know exactly what they're going to find him doing because he's done it 3 times a day, every single day. They know exactly where he's going to be. They know exactly what he's going to be doing. He's going to be on his knees. He's going to be praying. And he's going to have his windows open pointing to the holy city that's now lying in ruins. But Daniel knows that God is there with him. So what is there to worry about? Do we face situations where actually we think the thing we're facing is bigger and greater than the God that we know and that we say we love? When we walk out of these doors, do we think we leave God behind? That like this is actually where God lives? Because for a lot of people with the city of Jerusalem and the Holy Temple in ruins, where's God? God must have gone. But the reality was that God, even when they were in exile, was still at work. He still had plans. He still had purposes. He was still wanting to use his people to bring about that they were a holy nation. They were to represent him to the other nations, a shining light in the darkness. And the same is for us here. When we walk out of the doors, it's not like we leave God here on a Sunday and he sits here for the rest of the week hoping that we're all right. God goes before us into each and every situation that we face. God is here within us, wherever we may go. His Spirit dwells within me. We've been singing about it tonight. I said, Daniel is condemned for relying on the faithfulness of God. And as we see the king, the ruler of this vast empire, who has all this power, he's now actually powerless to help Daniel, this man that he knows is so loyal. He's unable to revoke the faithful law that now has trapped his favored one, the man who he was going to place the trust of his entire empire into his hands. And this greatly upsets the king. I don't know whether you noticed as Andrew was reading the story, Daniel hasn't said anything. Daniel has said nothing at this point in the story, in this chapter. All we know he's done is he's prayed and he's thanked God. He hasn't argued. He hasn't gone, well, actually, as the second most powerful man, or almost the second most powerful man in the entire empire, I'm now standing and I'm going to throw you lot out. He's saying nothing. But it's the king who's actually trying to save him. Do you know, sometimes we don't actually have to say anything in certain situations that we face. I remember once when I was working at NatWest Bank, and I don't know if I shared this story before, but I worked in the back office at NatWest, and there was a team of about three or four of us that worked together, and I was the sort of person, I didn't, you know, if people said, oh, what do you do at the weekend? I'd kind of go, I went to church. I went and helped at the youth group. Or I've been on a weekend away with a group of young people. And, you know, if questions followed on, I'd happily answer them. But I didn't stand there and, you know, and go, yes, I'm a Christian. I'm better than you or anything else like that. I just tried to do my best and be the best person that I could be in the jobs that I was given. In many ways, I try to be a bit of a Daniel and do it with integrity and good character. And this one particular day, somebody was leaving and they brought round this box of chocolates and there was rum truffles in it. And I'd gone from, when I was before a Christian, I was working in the bank, I would go and have a liquid lunch on a Friday to then deciding I wanted to be part of this church. And I didn't want to drink anymore because there was issues within my family. And so I made a personal decision. I'm going to give up drinking. Well, we're having this, you know, the chocolates are coming round. And this girl comes up, my colleagues comes up to me and she just goes, there's all these different chocolates and this is it, and you can't have those. They're a rum truffle. It's got alcohol in it. So you can't have it. I was like, oh, okay. And then she goes, and anyway, you're a Bible bash. And she just literally just started berating me, like, and I'm just sat there with my mouth wide open. I thought she was actually going to throw a chocolate in at one point, but she didn't. And I'm trying to think, what the heck do I say now? I mean, she was verbally going, you know, she was verbal daggers and everything was, and I'm sitting there going, when one of the other girls in the office, she just suddenly leaps up and kind of stands in between us. And for 10 minutes, the two of them are arguing about me and about whether I was actually a really good person or not. And what the point I'm trying to get across here is, I didn't actually have to say anything. Because Katie, who stood up and was very, you know, saw the injustice of it all, was actually doing a far greater job, even though she's not a Christian, of going, well, if Ian believes in the Bible and in Jesus, then that's fantastic because that actually makes him a better person. And then we should be thankful for who he is and what he does around here because he actually looks out for all. And I'm sitting there going, I'm going to write about that. Okay. And so what we see here, Daniel doesn't actually have to defend himself because the king is trying to find a way to do it for him. The most powerful man in the empire is trying to save him. And he's so distressed that he can't do it. But even the ruler of the greatest empire is powerless and eventually calls out to Daniel. As Daniel's being lowered into the lion's den before sunset. And these are the words of King Darius. May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. And he doesn't leave it there. He spends the night fasting, praying, unable to sleep, sending away the entertainment that's probably been prepared for him, whatever that might be, spending the night probably pacing backwards and forwards, worrying about Daniel. And Daniel's now sealed into the lion's den. And there are many seals placed around the stone so that no one can secretly go and rescue him. And the king's probably sitting there going, or pacing around going, how could this happen? What could I have done? Why did I sign that law? What can I do? There's no one else like Daniel in my kingdom. And I can't do anything. But on the flip side, I wonder what was happening for Daniel. I wonder if Daniel actually got any sleep. I wonder if he found himself a nice, big, furry, warm pillow. Because God steps in. And the mouths of the lions are shut. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking back to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where, is it Lucy? At the end of, if you've seen the film, she's talking to Mr. Tumnus. And he says, you know, Aslan is a friendly lion, but he's not a tame lion. I just get that picture. What does Daniel spend the night doing? When we get to heaven, I'd love to go up to Daniel and say, what did you do that night? Did you get a good night's sleep? Because continually he's been putting his trust and his faith in God. I'd just love it if Daniel turned around and said, do you know, lions make the best pillows. They're amazing. And so at sunrise the next morning, King Darius, in anguish, rushes to the lion's den. He's not been able to sleep. He's been pacing back and forth. And at the earliest moment he can, he needs to know what's happened. And so he shouts out, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Now we hear Daniel speak in this chapter. First words, may the king live forever. He praises the king, who he's had this relationship with for so long, who was the one who signed the decree to put him in there in the first place. And then he explains what's happened. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty. He still has respect, he still has integrity, and he still has good character. Because I think if I'd have been Daniel, I'd be going, what were you thinking? I know you're the king, but duh. He's not been harmed at all. He has trusted in God. And the king throws his accusers and their families into the lion's den. And they are made into a very quick meal. Without the protection of God, the lions will soon pounce. If we think we can do better on our own, the lions will soon get us. But if we put our trust in God, he will be faithful. And then the king writes a new decree. And he writes it to all the nations throughout the empire. Let me just read it to you again, because I think this is incredible. This is from King Darius, or Darius, depending on how you want to say it. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. And so we are then seeing verse 28. Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Israel had been called to be an example of God's salvation and glory to the surrounding nations. Even in exile, the remnant, those like Daniel, the leftovers, are demonstrating that there is no one greater than God, no matter what we face. And I think that still remains true for us today. Because as it's his people today, our world is ever changing. Laws are coming and going. And it seems like we can't even keep up with the changes that are being made. But in this ever-changing world, do we still keep God first? With prayer as our continual good habit. Are you continually seeking God and seeking his face, no matter what it is you face? Because God is faithful to us. Are we to him in the face of fire or a pack of lions? Still faithful to him? Or do we try to please everyone else before we try and please God? I was having a conversation, I've had a couple of conversations the last couple of weeks, and talking to different people about how easy it is to try and please everyone and end up pleasing no one. That no matter how hard we try and please everybody, that even, you know, as a pastor in ministry, we can try and we want everybody to feel great and be good and moving on with God, but it's impossible to actually please everybody. Sometimes some of the things we say and sometimes the things we do, even though we know they're right and they're good, there'll be some people who just will not like it for whatever reason. We cannot please everyone. But above all else, we should seek to please God first and foremost. And I wonder if suddenly a group came and knocked on your door, would we be caught doing the right thing? The thing that God would want us to do? Or would we be caught trying to fit in with everyone else? Trying to just be part of the crowd? Whether it's at home, at school, at college, at university, at work, in our social circle, amongst our families? Do we just try and fit in? Or do we try and please God? Because the God who saves Daniel is the same God who is with us now. The God who sent Jesus, the God who sent the Holy Spirit, is still with us today. And though this world might be rapidly changing, he never does. Because he is mighty to save above all powers, above all authorities and dominions. Are you in the habit of knowing him each and every day? Andrew.
In this place of reflecting on God's word for us, this place of do we, dare we, will we trust God in every single situation, even when the odds are stacked against us, even when temptations to do things our way or do things that are not God's way are around us. How do we stand? Just even tonight, just to be in a place where you say, God, I trust you. No matter what comes against me, no matter what I have to deal with, I trust you and I will walk with you and I will do the right thing. Just make that your heart commitment.